The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. This week we clear the decks and make way for a brilliant cosmologist, MIT's Max Tegmark. Max's latest book, Our Mathematical Universe, takes the reader on a grand tour of our scientific understanding of the cosmos. And in particular, the book focuses on his own interest in multiverses, the alternate universes that might sit beyond, beside and within our own universe. But the title of Max's book, Our Mathematical Universe, points to a much grander theory, and the real point of his text, that everything around us, from fundamental particles and forces of nature to the expanses of space and time, all this is not just explained by mathematics, but is mathematics. It's a truly grand idea, on one level a seemingly reductive notion, and in some sense a counterintuitive description of who we are. So it was a rare pleasure to have Max into the Guardian studios to discuss at length our mathematical universe. Max, tell us first why you decided to write this book.
I decided to write this book because I really want to encourage people to think big. We have again and again and again, we humans, discovered that everything we thought existed was just a small part of a much grander structure. A planet, a solar system, a galaxy, a universe, and maybe even a hierarchy of parallel universes. But we've also repeatedly underestimated the power of our human minds to understand our cosmos and even through technology to improve it. And I think it's so easy to feel powerless in this day and age and say, oh, you know, stuff is so big and I don't matter. And I wanted to combat that. The size of the cosmos is good, not bad in my book, because it just means we have more opportunities. And this incredible ability of our human minds to make a difference, I think, is something we mustn't underestimate.
Before we get into the meat of the book, just tell me how you ended up getting into physics yourself.
That's quite funny, really, because when I was a high school student, my single most boring subject was physics. And that's later made me put much more effort into my own teaching, because I realized what a difference teaching can make. And I only later was given a book by a friend of mine, by this physicist, Richard Feynman, which wasn't about physics at all. But I was so intrigued by the fact that he obviously loved physics that I thought to myself, how can he love this boring subject? I decided to start reading a science book he had written, and it was like a revelation. This huge light bulb went off in my head, and I realized that physics isn't just some kind of boring bag of tricks for calculating stuff. It's a detective story, and it's the ultimate intellectual detective story where we're trying to figure out the greatest mystery of all, namely, how does this reality work that we're part of? And I just feel so incredibly fortunate to have gotten to be a part of this detective quest myself. And the reason I wrote this book was because I want to share this excitement with the reader. So if you who are listening to this decide to read the book too, then it won't just be, you know, my quest, but our quest.
You start off in the book talking about issues that people will probably feel fairly comfortable about, sort of measurements of the observable universe, how far it is to certain stars, how far it is to the sun, and how these things were measured in the really early days back in the day. And then you move on to speaking about multiverses and different types of multiverses. Can you just take us through what you mean by a multiverse and what the different types are?
Yeah, before we go to other universes, let's remind ourselves what we mean by our universe, first of all. We don't mean what I thought universe meant when I was a kid, namely just everything. In astronomy, by our universe, we simply mean the spherical region of space from which light has had time to reach us so far during the 13.8 billion years since our Big Bang, because that's all we can ever observe with the best imaginable telescopes. So if space is bigger than that, then by definition, there are parallel universes. And what's quite remarkable is that even though we didn't go looking for parallel universes or necessarily want them either, other discoveries in science have suggested in many independent ways that there might be various other kinds of parallel universes. And there are as many as four different levels of them that people talk about a lot now in science. Level one parallel universes are the simplest kind. You just have space going on much farther away than we can see. And if you happen to be living in another one of those universe-sized regions out there, you know, you'd learn the same stuff in physics class, but different things in history class, because over there, the particles started out in different places and history just played out in a different way. The level two multiverse is more diverse and interesting. Then you're talking about regions that are even farther away in space, where you would even learn different things in physics class. The level three parallel universes, they are, in a sense, right here. They come from quantum mechanics and involve the idea that our reality sometimes can branch out into parallel tracks, kind of like in the movie Sliding Doors. The level four multiverse is the most diverse of all, where you have these completely disconnected universes which obey different equations of physics.
The idea of multiverses still is a little controversial, or maybe a lot controversial, in physics, in the physics community itself. Why is there such a problem? Why do people call it sort of unscientific, or do they mean particular types of multiverse, or what?
That's a very important question. To me, the distinction between science and speculation comes down to whether you can measure things, whether you can test and falsify your ideas. So it's natural to wonder whether it's unscientific to talk about other universes when, by definition, we can't observe them. The key thing to be clear on, though, is that these parallel universes are not theories. They're the prediction of certain theories, which are in turn scientific because they predicted other stuff that we can measure and test. For example, Einstein's theory of general relativity is a very scientific theory. It predicts loads of stuff about how gravity bends light and GPS functions. So we take it seriously, but that forces us to take seriously also what it predicts for what happens inside of black holes, even though we cannot go in and observe that. I mean, we can't just opt out of black holes because we don't like them. If we don't like them, we have to invent a different mathematical theory that doesn't have black holes, but which can explain everything else. And it's the same way with parallel universes. We have the theory, for example, known as cosmological inflation, which has been very successful in predicting why we live in this universe. It's very flat, almost uniform, but with these tiny fluctuations which have gradually grown into the galaxies, the stars, and the planets around us today. We've confirmed this theory of inflation beautifully with recent measurements from the Planck satellite, baby pictures of our universe, from 3D galaxy maps. So it's emerged as the most popular theory of what happened early on. That doesn't mean it's correct, but it means it's scientific. So we're forced to also take seriously another prediction that inflation makes, which is that space is actually much bigger than the part of space that we call our universe.
One of the things I've always wondered about the multiverses, when you see these different levels talked about, is whether they are mutually exclusive, whether we have to have, it has to be level one or level two, or can we have all of these or some of these together?
We could, in principle, have all of them nested within each other, sort of like Russian dolls, except each Russian doll could have many dolls inside of it as well. So the most extreme situation could be that we have many, 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 maybe infinitely many universes in a level one multiverse in this big space. And then we have all these different level one multiverses in this even bigger space, the level two multiverse. Then we have all these different level two multiverses in a level three multiverse, which in turn is just one out of many in the level four multiverse. And ultimately, the way to figure out better how much of this to take seriously and not to take seriously is to go after each of the individual theories that predict this stuff. We mentioned inflation, which we're hoping to test better in the years ahead here, and we get either more or less confidence in. Similarly, the level three kind, for example, with quantum mechanics, we can test very beautifully by building bigger quantum devices. You know, it's predicted the level three multiverse by this simple version of quantum mechanics that says that everything in our universe is governed by something called the Schrödinger equation, with no exceptions. And if we try to build a really, really big quantum computer, which there's a multi-million dollar or multi-million pound effort to do now, and it fails, and we find that, oh, it's because this equation wasn't quite working, you know, bye-bye level three multiverse. Whereas if we succeed in building one of these machines and it can in 1 minute solve a math problem that would take more than the age of our universe to do on an ordinary computer by effectively tapping into the computational power of these parallel universes, then I think a lot more people are going to take seriously the idea that, hey, they really exist.
So take me through that. How does someone building a quantum computer give you a sense that there is this other particular type of multiverse?
We know that quantum particles have this weird property that they can be in several places at once. And for a long time, people thought this was just a funny quirk of nature that wasn't useful for anything. But more recently, it's become clear that we can actually exploit this sort of schizophrenic nature of reality to help us solve certain kinds of problems faster. And for example, if you want to write a computer program that runs faster today, you often parallelize it by having many different processors which do different parts of the calculation independently. Well, a quantum computer can, in a certain sense, do the ultimate parallelization where different parts of the calculation are done in these parallel universes, and then in the end, the computer sort of puts it all together and tells you, here is the answer. There's one of the reasons there's so much funding in this now, ironically, has to do with cryptography and privacy, because the most popular code in crypto we use online involves a math problem of taking two really big prime numbers that have been multiplied together and figuring out what they were, which is super hard in an ordinary computer, but which Peter Shor showed that a quantum computer can just crush.
But I think what you're talking about there is that a quantum computer might be able to sort of do a whole load of calculations simultaneously, but that to me feels like something that would be going on within the sort of observable universe as we see it. But you're talking about calculations happening in other universes, which is still stumping me.
Well, if all you had access to was the 10 to the power 78 atoms in our universe, you still wouldn't be able to solve these math problems in billions of years. You need vastly more resources than that. And that's what's so incredibly clever about the quantum computing algorithms, that they take advantage of this quantum parallelism to be able to really, really do more. But fundamentally, you know, we don't know yet which version of quantum mechanics is correct. People have argued about that for almost 100 years now. The old school so-called Copenhagen interpretation says that this Schrodinger equation actually does not always apply, that it actually breaks down sometimes when some part of the system observes some other part of the system, causing what's called the wave function collapse. The other approach, which is known as the Everett version, this says, no, the Schrodinger equation always works. And you can test this by gradually building bigger and bigger systems. Many physicists early on thought that quantum mechanics would only really work for tiny atomic scale stuff. But more recently, for example, Anton Zeilinger in Vienna has done this incredible experiment where he measures quantum effects over hundreds of kilometers. And so far, the Schrodinger equation, I have to say, is looking real good. So the jury is out. We don't know what the truth is going to be, but it's obviously a scientific question. And as we come to terms with whether the Schrodinger equation ultimately holds for everything or not, we'll know better whether we should take seriously this level three multiverse.
Take me through this a bit more, though, because there's this whole idea in the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics where, because it says that a particle can be in two places at once, there's a kind of a fudge that you say, oh, yeah, well, because measurements only tell us one answer, then you say, OK, so the equation that describes where this stuff is, this wave equation, collapses to a point where it says, OK, this is your answer. Now, it seems like what Everett is saying, what you're saying, is that actually the wave function doesn't have to collapse, that it almost just gets modified and moves on but then some of the information gets suppressed. Take me through that.
So what Niels Bohr originally said was that something really random happens when you look at something and the particle sort of snaps to attention and all of a sudden it really is here or there rather than here and there as it had previously been. And the reason that a lot of physicists have spent almost 100 years arguing about this and feeling uneasy about it is because this is not a mathematical theory anymore, saying that the Schrodinger equation always holds except when it doesn't, unless you can give an equation saying, well, what is an observation exactly? Does it require a human consciousness, or is your cat good enough, or a mouse, or what a video camera, or just a single particle, you know? And so far, we've never seen any evidence that the Schrödinger equation actually really does break down. So it's these experiments that have sort of cast aspersions on this. And then in the meantime, this young grad student, Hugh Everett, came along in the 50s and said, actually, if there is no wave function collapse, and you just look what the Schrödinger equation says happens when you look at the particle, it says that information about the particle's location goes into your brain. So now the particles in your brain are also in two places at once. Then you tell your friend about it, and your particles in your friend's brain are also in multiple places. Maybe ultimately the outcome of this experiment decides whether you get a Nobel Prize or not. So now all your particles are either in my hometown of Stockholm or they're not. So this tiny quantum uncertainty gets amplified into these really big things, which makes you ask, well, why on earth do we never see our friends in multiple places, at least while we're sober, you know? But then it was realized actually that the Schrödinger equation answers this too by giving a censorship effect that's become known as decoherence, that explains that even if you are actually in two places at once, each of the yous will be completely unaware of the other and feel that something just random happened. And this is how these level three parallel universes come about, if the Schrödinger equation is really correct.
So does that mean there'd be one of these equations would describe the universe, like a Schrödinger equation for the universe? Or is there do you break it down into any system you might look at, like you and me chatting? Is there one equation for that and one for producer Jason listening in, or, you know?
No, it's very, very simple. Just like you said, from Everett's point of view, there's only one wave function, only one Schrödinger equation for the whole thing. It just, and it describes the full reality of everything that's happening. It's just that this full quantum reality is so big that we humans are only aware of a small part of it. It's very analogous, really, to how space itself might be much bigger than the part of space that we can see. And we humans have long had a little tendency towards hubris, liking to imagine that, oh, everything centers around us and somehow we must be able to know everything. I think the truth is we don't know for sure how big reality is, so we need to be open for the possibility that maybe we just can't observe all of it.
One of the interpretations of Hugh Everett's work was that every time there is a possibility of things happening in different ways, which presumably is as small as a time scale you can imagine, that the universe kind of splits into these different realities and splits and splits and splits and so on like that. And is that a misinterpretation?
It is a misinterpretation in the sense that at the fundamental level, our universe itself doesn't care about any of this. There's just one wave function. The universe is doing its thing, obeying the Schrödinger equation. But from our subjective perspective, as inhabitants in this universe, initially there was, your particles were all in one place and you felt it was very unambiguous what was happening. Later on, there are these two different versions of you, you know, doing different things. It's much like if there is another version of you in the level one multiverse, you know, some Googleplex meters away, and I have maybe that version of you has the same memories as this one, but decided to have something else for breakfast. You know, he is going to feel that he's you. He's completely unaware that there's another you far away in space. So there are two yous, but from the point of the universe itself, there's still only one space.
Right. Okay. Kind of takes back to something a little bit more, maybe a bit easier to get a head around, actually, although it's still quite not wacky, but still quite, you know, tricky. And this idea that one of the multiverse ideas would be that there are different patches of space where the effective rules of physics will be kind of different. And so some of these regions will not be conducive to life, and some will be conducive to life. And we are in one, by definition, that is conducive to life, because if it wasn't, we wouldn't be here, right? And, you know, which is this whole anthropic principle, the whole idea that, you know, we're kind of in a privileged place, which a lot of physicists seems to get their back right up. What is the problem with that as an answer? Is it frustrating? Does it mean it's wrong?
So this is indeed another very old and controversial idea. Steven Weinberg wrote an intriguing paper many years ago making this argument, pointing out that if there were such a thing as dark energy, then it would poison the formation of galaxies. So if the amount of dark energy was different in different parts of space, most of space would just be stone dead. But we would find ourselves in one of those few places where there actually were galaxies, and we would expect to see that there is actually some dark energy of a certain amount that he predicted. Most people dismiss this for two reasons. One is, you know, there didn't seem to be any dark energy. And second, there was no physical mechanism for why dark energy would change from place to place. Then two things changed. First, dark energy was discovered by astronomers who noticed that, hey, our universe is expanding, and they even got a Nobel Prize for it. And they discovered dark energy roughly at the amount that Steven Weinberg had predicted. The second thing which changed and made people take this more seriously was that we actually got a mechanism all of a sudden, because it became clear that what we used to think of as empty space might be better thought of as some kind of substance. Now, the substance of water, you know, we study its equations, it can be in three different ways. It can be ice or liquid or steam. And string theorists found that their equations for the substance of space likewise had many different solutions, more than three, maybe 10 to the 500 or so, and each one had a different value of the dark energy. And it was also realized that this inflation theory we talked about, which is our most popular explanation for what made our universe so big and with the properties it has, it's really, really violent. And while it's busy making space, it actually makes space in all these different versions, with all the different versions of the dark energy. And then that leads immediately to the prediction that, you know, most of space is really dead. It's kind of like we're in the Sahara Desert, you know, when we find ourselves in an oasis. It's hardly surprising that we find ourselves in one of the few places where we can live, neither in the Sahara or in the vastness of space. We don't, of course, know for sure either that string theory is correct or that inflation happened. But the reason people are taking this more seriously is because, first of all, you can no longer say that this is unscientific, since it's predicted by certain scientific theories. And second, hey, you know, we found dark energy, and this is the only really compelling explanation so far in science for why it has the value that it does.
The idea that we are in this privileged position, I mean, is why do people find that frustrating? Is there a sense that there needs to be an explanation as to why we, that goes further than that, from the bottom up?
Some physicists had hoped earlier that they would be able to predict every single constant of nature just from first principles. You know, but we have to be honest and accept that our job as scientists is not to tell our universe how to behave, but to look at it with an open mind and see how it is. And it's just like, you know, you're a journalist. If you're following some investigative trail, you have to follow the clues wherever they take you, even if you don't like where they lead you, even if they implicate your best friend in that scandal you're investigating. And for us, well, it just turned out, perhaps, that our universe wasn't quite the way we thought, that we could predict all these numbers from first principles. Long ago, people probably hoped that we could predict from first principles the number of planets in our solar system. 8, you know, sorry, Pluto. Because they only knew about one solar system, and that seemed to be this really basic property of our universe, 8. Now that seems ludicrous, because we know there are all these other solar systems with 3 planets and 5 planets, and the 8 is just part of our intergalactic postal code, you know. And it seems like where we might be heading here is that other things that we also were numbers that we thought we could predict by calculating pi squared, you know, and doing some fancy math, will also just turn out to be part of our address in space.
A lot of this stuff takes mathematics to understand properly, I'd say. But as you go through the book, you start to talk about us and the world and the universe actually as mathematical objects. And I'm interested in that shift. It's not just about using equations to understand things you're describing, how far away the sun is, how big the observable universe is. What do you mean when you say actually these are mathematical objects?
Yeah, the idea that there's something mathematical about our universe is, of course, very old. Galileo said that our universe seems to be a book written in the language of mathematics, and since then we've just kept discovering more and more mathematical regularities. Most recently, Peter Higgs predicted, using only these advanced mathematical equations of particle physics, that if you built the most advanced scientific instrument ever in Geneva, you'd find a new particle there. You know, we built it. There was the Higgs boson, and he got a free trip to my hometown. You know, so that's the uncontroversial part. Math is powerful in physics, where it gets controversial is your question, what do we make of this? So in my book, Our Mathematical Universe, I explore the whole range of possibilities, from the possibility that it means nothing, it's just some kind of fluke, or we made mathematics up or invented it, to the opposite extreme, that this really means that our universe is deeply mathematical at root. And I explore this mathematical universe hypothesis that our universe really is completely mathematical in the sense of being a mathematical structure, which basically boils down to saying that our universe doesn't just have some mathematical properties, but it has only mathematical properties. And this sounds totally ridiculous at first, of course, because, you know, when I look around myself here in this radio studio, I don't see anything that seems mathematical except maybe a number that one of you guys wrote here on your piece of paper. But yet I know as a physicist that everything in this studio and everywhere else in the universe, everything out here is made out of these elementary particles like quarks and electrons. And what properties does an electron have? It has the property -1, 1/2, 1. And we physicists have invented geeky names for these properties like electric charge and spin and lepton numbers. But the electron doesn't care what we call the properties. The properties are purely mathematical properties, these numbers. And as far as we can tell, both the electron and all the other elementary particles are purely mathematical objects in the sense that they have no properties at all except these mathematical properties. And what about the space that all these particles are in? You know, what properties does space have? It has the property 3, the largest number of pencils you can put perpendicular to each other. You know, again, we scientists came up with a nerdy name for this. We call it the dimensionality of space. But space doesn't care what we call it. The property is a number. And Einstein discovered some more mathematical properties of space called topology and curvature. So as far as we know, space is a purely mathematical object with no properties except mathematical properties. So if you grant that both space and all the stuff in space is purely mathematical, then it starts to sound a little bit less insane that maybe everything is mathematical. The computer revolution has made it much easier for us to understand how many things which we used to think of as having nothing to do with math can actually be represented as numbers, whether it be an image that you email your friend or a song you listen to on your iPod or a video. And it's interesting to think about how in physics as well, when I start teaching next week, for example, about the electromagnetic field at MIT, the way we actually represent this as is almost like a pixelized image, except in three dimensions. We have these voxels, 3D pixels, where with each voxel in space, there is a bunch of numbers sitting there, which tell you how strong the magnetism is and so on. Then we have these equations that it obeys. So the more closely we look at our universe, the stronger the analogies actually become with the way it would feel to a video game character studying the computer game that they're inside of.
What about things like energy? And you would say a particle would, you know, you say, well, we just describe it with a certain energy, a certain GV over C squared or whatever. You know, we give it a certain energy. Mm-hmm. But are you saying that there is no energy?
What is energy, really? It's ultimately a number. And
is it, though?
Well, you know, this idea that everything is somehow made out of stuff seemed very compelling back in the days when we didn't know what stuff was. You know, we took for granted that even the smallest building blocks that everything is made out of, like the atoms, they must have, you know, stuff kind of properties, like a color and a texture and a smell, you know. But actually, what we've learned at the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva and elsewhere is that, to the best of our knowledge, the electron doesn't have a color or a smell or a texture. The only properties it has are these numbers. And instead, what seems to really matter a lot about our world aren't, you know, what determines the properties of, for example, a cat is not so much the nature of the particles that make it up, but more the relations between the particles for how they're put together. Right? The cat is just a bunch of cat food rearranged, which makes a whole load of difference. And you know, it's remarkable how complicated things you can build up by these Legos, these elementary particles, that themselves have almost no properties at all. So we live in a sort of relational reality in that sense, where it's the relations that are more important than the substrate.
if I go and talk to my news editor and say, look, I've just spoken to this guy and he's incredibly bright and he's just told me that everything is just maths. It's maths, just maths. The first thing he'll say to me is, so what? And how should I answer him? What difference does it make if that's the way we either see the universe reality or if that's actually the way it is?
First of all, it makes absolutely no difference to how the feeling of falling in love or the fragrance of a rose. So we should not in any way feel offended or different about, you know, what we are as a result. However, I think it does inject a certain optimism into the whole scientific enterprise, because if I'm wrong about this guess that things are all mathematical, then physics is ultimately going to be doomed, because we're going to hit a roadblock beyond which we can't proceed, because we're going to have no more mathematical regularities to find. And that's, well, in the past always helped us make progress, right? Whereas if it's all mathematical, there is no roadblock. So we might not be clever enough to figure everything out, but there's nothing in principle stopping us from figuring out our reality better and better. And our ability to ultimately understand our cosmos is only going to be limited by our own imagination.
There's this lovely thing in your book where you talk about how you had to develop and work on some of your more interesting, sort of wackier ideas, if you like, and sort of pretend that these were a side interest rather than what is probably your main interest. And that you quoted an email from a senior professor, who I think you didn't name, saying that publishing papers on some of these ideas was going to jeopardize your career. And is this, tell me about that. I mean, is that something that is a peculiar to you, or is that a real risk of physicists who are trying to sort of push up the boundaries a bit?
Oh, I think that's really par for the course. We've seen again and again throughout the history of science how many really excellent ideas were initially poo-pooed and rejected. At the same time, I mean, it's healthy to have that skepticism in the physics community, because there are also a lot of ideas that used to be pushed as serious science, like the theory of ghosts, which are now considered to have absolutely nothing to do with science. So it's good to have that, you know, pushback back and forth. But I would encourage any young physicist listening to this, or old physicists too, for that matter, to keep doing the things that their heart gets them really fired up about as well. Because what I did was I spent a significant fraction of my time doing more safe things, which I knew were going to pay off, so that I knew I could sort of pay my dues to the community and do useful stuff. And then on my own spare time, thought about these other things, which most of my colleagues considered, you know, too speculative then. And I'm actually very happy to see now that many of the ideas which people used to just sneeze at 20 years ago have now gone from being dismissed as just not scientific to being considered controversial but scientific. So we actually talk about them at physics conferences. Parallel universes, for example. We certainly don't know for sure today whether they exist or not, but the people who are guessing that they don't exist have changed their critique from being, oh, this makes no sense and I hate it, to just saying, I hate it.
If we were to have a rummage around in Max Tegmark's book, a bag of sort of wacky ideas, what else is in there that you're harboring as something that's going to be cool to look into the future?
I think the issue of consciousness is exactly one of those things. Like Christoph Koch actually confessed at this conference that although he's a very celebrated neuroscientist now, he got tenure at Caltech, you know, he was warned to not work on consciousness before he had tenure, because that was considered too philosophical, you know, in his field. And if it really is true that this incredible phenomenon that it feels like there's a movie in your head is something which can actually be understood ultimately through some remarkably complicated patterns that particles move around, and, you know, then we're missing out on a lot of fun discoveries by just running away from that area. If you imagine a patient in the hospital who's not responding, you know, right now we take for granted that there's no way of knowing whether that patient is conscious or not. Hey, but maybe there is one day. Maybe one day we can look more carefully at some brain scan and say, oh, you know, this patient is really conscious. Or this animal here who these industry executives are claiming feels no pain when you do these things to it, actually is conscious. I don't think these are questions which are necessarily, we don't know if it's ever going to be possible to figure it out, but I think it's not clear at all that it's not possible either. I think we should try. Not to mention, if we build super intelligent computers in the future, it's going to be very important to know whether they actually feel conscious also, or whether they're just like zombies fooling us into thinking they're conscious.
Our Mathematical Universe is published by Alan Lane and out in all good on and offline bookshops. A huge thanks to Max Tegmark. We'll have links to Max's work at MIT on the blog for this podcast. But from me, Ian Sample, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, thanks for listening. We'll be back next Monday.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag-and-drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.